Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Trump's second indictment rocks the presidential race as plans move forward for a Florida trial. DeSantis finally signs the state budget, and Florida is poised for another clash over advanced placement courses. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and those are some of the stories I'll be discussing this week with Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy and Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. But first, gentlemen, it's time for some numbers. John, what do you have for us today?
Yeah, Zach, I do have a number this week, and it's a lucky 13.
Oh, man, you're jinxing the podcast early on here. How about you, Antonio?
I'm coming just with a simple three.
Three, all right, and I'm going high today with a 35 million. Remember those numbers, folks. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, last week was a wild scene in Florida as Trump was arraigned in a federal courthouse in Miami on 37 felony charges, alleging that he mishandled classified documents. Governor Ron DeSantis and most Republicans immediately came to Trump's defense, alleging a political prosecution, and the GOP base seems to be largely sticking with the former president. Antonio, what can you tell us about how Trump's indictment is playing out politically, and what comes next with this case?
Well, it's playing out in both political and legal ways. Politically, look, it's made a pardon of the former president a campaign issue for the first time since 1976. That's when then-President Gerald Ford had to defend his pardon of Richard Nixon in the aftermath of the Watergate crimes. This time, though, candidates like Governor Ron DeSantis are wearing their bully pulpit promise to pardon Trump like a badge of honor, almost like saying they'll come to Trump's rescue, like a knight coming to rescue a damsel in distress. And in fact, DeSantis said he would use the pardon powers, quote-unquote, aggressively. Obviously, the pardon pledge is an attempt by the governor and the others to convince the GOP hard right base that they are fully against what they call the, quote-unquote, the weaponized law enforcement. But overall, the political site 538's review of polling since the indictment shows that, you know, this legal salvo at Trump has done little to move the public opinion needle on the former president either way. That's despite public comments Trump has made since the indictment. There seem to be quasi-confessions. Most notably was his claim in a Fox News interview earlier this week in which he said he kept the boxes with classified documents because he also had personal items interspersed with the top secret files, did he mean to say that he felt retrieving his personal items like golf artifacts was more important than proper security for some of the nation's top secrets? That was a really bizarre, if not concerning, claim. Yet, 538's polling average has Trump at standing steady at 53.5% among Republicans, and that's just 0.3%, you know, a fraction of 1% down since the indictment. And again, that's the polling average among Republicans. So, you know, and legally, you know, Trump's indictment put the spotlight on a judge he appointed to the bench when during his single term in the White House. Yes, District Judge Eileen Cannon was assigned to preside over the case, and you know, that also drew a lot of scrutiny given some controversial decisions she made last year when Trump was litigating with the federal government, the Justice Department, after the FBI search and seizure of Mar-a-Lago. Judge Cannon at the time made some rulings regarding a special master that people, legal analysts said, really departed from her role in the case and really departed from legal precedent. And in fact, those rulings were overturned and slapped back at her by an appeals court. So the coverage of the case itself and the judge is it's almost going to be as intense as the coverage of Trump and what he did or didn't do in the allegations and the indictment. You know, so like I said, we'll be covering the case, which has all sorts of potential constitutional questions. But I'll say one last thing. You know, you mentioned the public spectacle that we saw at the courthouse that day in Miami. You know, as expected, there were hundreds of supporters and opponents and onlookers, people that were just curious were there, as well as a bunch of people dressed as either Uncle Sam, a prison inmate, and a circus master. But I will say this, the most telling moment of the day in Miami was after the arraignment when Trump was headed back to Miami International Airport, and he stopped at the Versailles restaurant, which is a landmark of Cuban-American politics and social life in Miami. But here's the thing. The mood there wasn't jubilant or defiant. Rather, you had a rabbi and a minister offered prayers in English and in Spanish, and patrons shouted words of encouragement like, you know, Jesus loves you and we love you and so forth. So that moment, that atmosphere served to show that there was seemed to be an acknowledgement that Trump does face serious legal jeopardy here. And the last thing I'll say to this is, you know, the indictment promises to bring the trial of the millennium. I mean, we're not going to just say it's a century here. We're going to go the entire next thousand years. We'll call it for the next 1,000 years. It's going to be at Fort Pierce, Florida. And you may recall that Fort Pierce a year ago got 15 minutes of fame when they were the host site for the DeSantis debate against Democrat Charlie Crist. Well, Fort Pierce is now going to really be on the map when the entire planet descends on that town on the Atlantic coast, a Treasure Coast town, for this trial.
Yeah, kind of a unusual place for the nation's future to sort of hinge here is Fort Pierce, but we'll be having pretty aggressive coverage of it. I'm sure we have a paper over there, the Treasure Coast paper, and I know Antonio, you guys at the Palm Beach Post, I'm sure will be keeping a close eye on it. You mentioned the polling averages, Antonio, and they haven't really moved. I saw just the latest poll that came out from Emerson College had Trump at 59% support in the GOP primary to 21% for DeSantis. So a 38% percentage point difference right there. I mean, I did see one poll that indicated that Trump's favorability might have come down a little bit here. They said that it dropped about 10 points in this survey among GOP voters, and that was a statistically significant decline. But overall, he still looks pretty strong. Do you think that there's any opening here for DeSantis to make this electability case? I mean, he's not going at Trump directly. It's not a full frontal assault where he's going to criticize him over these legal cases. He just seems to think that there's no appetite for it within the GOP base. But as you mentioned, like the atmosphere in Versailles, this restaurant, you know, maybe Trump's favorability dips a little bit. Maybe there's sort of a little bit of a dawning among Republicans that Trump is in some serious legal jeopardy here. And even if they think that this is a political prosecution, do you think that there's maybe some people who are thinking, well, you know, I still like Trump, but I'm not sure how electable he is in a general election?
Well, that's been the claim. But here's, I was talking to a GOP strategist type this week, and this is just one viewpoint. So again, I wouldn't read too much into it. But the interesting topic is what this person was saying is that the time period, the next 2 months, are going to be kind of interesting along those lines. And the reason 2 months is because on August 23rd is when the Republican presidential candidates will meet in Milwaukee for their first debate. It's going to be really, if there is going to be that opening, and if it's going to be because of this indictment, and as more details work through the system, that first debate may be the moment where, particularly if Trump doesn't show up, where these other candidates are going to have the opportunity to basically step out and say, hey, look, make the electability, you know, claim, you know, basically raise what's in the indictment, what's come out. I think that one of the things that this person told me that really got to watch is not the indictment itself, but Trump's own comments, you know, and more interviews like the one that he did on Fox News with Bret Baier earlier this week. It could be really damaging. And we may actually see that. We may actually see movement in the polls, not massive movement, but enough that by the time that the candidates get to that debate stage, that they will feel comfortable. Okay, we can really hammer away at the electability issue and the actual and all the legal this legal case without offending the base or without seemingly being disloyal or without airing the, you know, taking the side of quote unquote weaponized government and weaponized law enforcement and the talking points that are out there. So I think, you know, to answer your question, the next 8 weeks or so leading to that debate are going to be crucial.
Yeah. And the problem for all of Trump's challengers is they're trying to make this sort of delicate argument and sort of dance around it a bit and say, well, I think that the DOJ is weaponized, but I don't think that Trump can win. And it's not, I mean, meanwhile, Trump is just saying witch hunt, witch hunt, witch hunt. And it's a much more aggressive and straightforward argument. And so I think that that plays to his advantage. But you made a good point. I mean, Trump is kind of that interview with Fox was not great for him. Meanwhile, DeSantis had an interview last night on Fox where it was, you know, he was getting softball questions and getting pretty easy treatment. So it does seem like that there's the potential there for some of the GOP base to sort of, absorb some of this stuff and quietly move away from Trump a little bit. We'll see how it develops. Well, as DeSantis campaigns for president, he's still trying to tie up some loose ends from the legislative session that ended in early May. The governor finally signed the state budget last week, more than a month after it was approved by the legislature. DeSantis also released his list of budget vetoes, and there's been some speculation that the governor really kind of held on to this budget for a while so he could use it as leverage over lawmakers and also lobbyists to get support for his presidential campaign. The Florida Democratic Party even filed an ethics complaint against some of DeSantis's top aides this week that touches on some of these questions. And Republican State Senator Joe Gruters lashed out at the governor and accused him of political retribution for vetoing projects in Gruters' district. Gruters is the only member of the Florida legislature who has come out in support of Trump. John, it seems like there's been more intrigue around the budget really than normal this year.
Yeah, there was some bipartisan grumbling with the way DeSantis leveled that $500 million of vetoes. Gruters, the Trump guy who DeSantis has had an uneasy relationship with, going back to when Gruters was the state Republican Party chairman. Well, his home region of Sarasota and Manatee counties lost about $30 million to vetoes. And then House Democrats pointed out that 40% of the 188 projects that they had in the budget were vetoed by DeSantis. Now, that compared with only 16% of what was more than 1,300 projects that Republicans got in it. So again, DeSantis playing hardball. I guess that's nothing new these days. But the final action on the budget was slow rolled to DeSantis by legislative leaders, and that gave him time to campaign across the country. And it also raised anxiety among some legislators and lobbyists who, as you pointed out, they were called by DeSantis staffers about projects that they had in the budget, leaving some with the impression that he was, you know, either demanding an endorsement or campaign contributions, depending on who you were. In the end, DeSantis has been endorsed by 99 of the 113 Republican legislators, and one veteran lobbyist I spoke to along the way kind of downplayed the effect of the staffers' call, saying that it didn't sound like extortion and that he'd heard far worse from other governors through the years. But all told, the budget is done for the year beginning July 1st. There's plenty of money in there for this that comes in from tax receipts in this state's kind of go-go economy. So that's something DeSantis can point to when he's out there campaigning, along with $1.3 billion in tax cuts that he managed to get into the budget too, which is a formidable amount and is going to play well when you're campaigning in New Hampshire or something like that. Also, he managed to take a swipe at the Biden administration with his vetoes, knocking off $24 million in federal money for local governments to promote energy programs. And then he killed another $5 million that was designed from the feds to offset inflation costs for local energy efforts. I'm sure this is something that he can label woke spending, I suppose. But with the budget behind him, you know, there's only a few more bills still to be signed, and that could be wrapped up actually this week even. So that will truly liberate DeSantis from Tallahassee and just let him campaign full time while the state effectively goes on autopilot.
The budget was really the biggest thing that he had to get done here. So there's been some talk that we're really not going to see DeSantis in Florida too much over the next few months, that he's going to be out in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada and all these early states, which he already has been quite a bit. Well, the budget debates were largely overshadowed this year by all of the red meat legislation that DeSantis pushed as he geared up to run for president, including expanding the so-called Don't Say Gay law that prohibits classroom instruction about sexual orientation or gender identity. These prohibitions now extend to older grades, which could set up a conflict over advanced placement courses that high school students take to get college credit. The Florida Department of Education recently asked for a review of all AP courses to see if they have any LGBTQ material. College Board, the nonprofit that oversees the AP courses, is gearing up for a fight over AP Psychology, which has a unit dealing with gender and sexual orientation. College Board says it won't change the course, with officials saying they learned their lesson after they bowed to pressure on the AP African American Studies course, revising it after DeSantis banned it in Florida. Antonio, this is another example of how DeSantis's so-called war on woke is really having some impacts in Florida. It would be pretty notable if AP Psych isn't offered in the state. I spoke to somebody who said that students already are signing up for it for next year.
Yeah, it would be. And again, it'd be one more, you know, disruption in the already in the Florida education landscape, which has seen a number of, as you just pointed out, a lot of upheaval. But the AP Psych program may end up just being another tombstone in Florida's woke cemetery. Gentlemen, you may have heard that Florida is where woke comes to die. But here's the thing, the woke war, which is governed DeSantis' key calling card on the campaign trail, isn't moving the needle for him in or outside of Florida. All the major pieces of anti-wokeness that the Florida GOP supermajority in Tallahassee approved this spring to bolster DeSantis' White House resume, well, it's not winning over the GOP base. DeSantis is trailing Trump, like we talked about, you know, 30 points in that 538 average and by double digits in individual key state polls, which ultimately are the ones that could be most telling, because that's how you win the nomination state by state, which raises a question. Namely, has DeSantis misread the political tea leaves? And here's what I've been hearing from a couple corners in the last month or so. And the reason I've been told by some GOP voters that DeSantis won in a rout last November, they think, is because voters rewarded him for opening the economy fast during the COVID pandemic. And also because he pushed to reopen schools and get kids back into classrooms. And because he sided with parents and others who opposed vaccination mandates for travel and general consumerism. Yes, DeSantis was criticized by public health experts that, you know, they were offering much more cautious guidance. And those public health experts said that his dismissive view of vaccinations and mask wearing rules unnecessarily led to many more deaths. But the general population, at least the people I've been speaking with, have told me, it suggests that they were simply more concerned with getting back to work, getting back to their normal lives. And that's a reason why they voted for him. Now, though, these same individuals, when I talk to them about things like the woke war, the six-week abortion ban, and the expansion of Don't Say Gay from third grade through middle school, and the feud with Walt Disney World, they said, you know, the feud with Disney seemed more personal, and expanding the Don't Say Gay, you know, law seemed a bit excessive, and they weren't so happy with the 6-week abortion ban. It's a small sampling, so I wouldn't stake too much on it, but it does suggest, Zach, that the attack on the AP Psych program may be a winner with DeSantis' most ardent supporters, but maybe not so valuable for everyone else.
And it's even something that Trump has tried to undermine a bit. And he had a notable comment where he was saying that, I don't even know what the word woke means. People overuse it and trying to kind of jab at DeSantis for how much he repeats this woke stuff all the time. And DeSantis has come back and doubled down on it, really. I mean, I was watching one of his most recent speeches, and he's like, some people have tried to dismiss woke or say it doesn't matter, but in Florida we know that it's critical to all defending all types of institutions or whatever. And so, he's in so deep on this stuff that I don't think that he can really change course on it. It's really become sort of a pillar of his presidential campaign, but it's having some of these, it's having some fallout that maybe he didn't completely anticipate. I'm not saying that he isn't interested in going after some of these other AP programs, but it'll be fascinating to see if this becomes a distraction for him while he's running for president. We'll move on to some numbers here. John, do you want to talk about yours?
Zach, yeah, I have 13, and 13 would have been the number of disciples Jesus had if Ron DeSantis had his way. Why the change? Well, DeSantis recently sat down for a lengthy interview at the governor's mansion with the Christian Broadcast Network. That's the organization founded by the late Pat Robertson, who, like DeSantis now, once ran for the Republican presidential nomination. Well, in this interview, mostly spent on the role faith has played in the governor's life, a big role, DeSantis says, he mentions that one point in history he would have loved to have been there, quote, been there with Jesus's disciples. He talks about how Peter went from being a fisherman to fishers of men. And then DeSantis says, these guys all went out and dedicated their lives to spread the gospel. I look back at that and I would have loved to have been there with them. That's kind of his conclusion. Well, it really does seem difficult to imagine our migrant flying, gender-affirming, defying, anti-DEI, anti-ESG, anti-woke governor being at ease at Jesus's side when he cured lepers, stopped a woman from being stoned and threw the money changers out of the temple. But hey, when you're seeking the evangelical vote in primary states like Iowa and South Carolina, maybe portraying yourself as wishing to be the 13th disciple is plausible to some people. Notably this week on Juneteenth, a bus rolled through Tallahassee called the Stay Woke Rolling Voter Case. That was organized by the Washington-based Transformative Justice Coalition, and it's partnering with Florida NAACP, among other organizations. Well, the Stay Woke bus is hitting several cities, and it's urging people to register to vote and stand by their woke principles. And here in Tallahassee, a prominent minister, the Reverend R.B. Holmes Jr., he said at the bus event, "Don't you know we serve a woke Lord?" So maybe I'm not the only one having trouble envisioning Peter, James, John, and Ron.
That was an interesting interview. DeSantis, he talks about he laces sort of references to God in some of his speeches and talks about being the armor of God, but he doesn't really wear his religion on his sleeve so much, and he definitely let it all out in that interview. Though you could tell that he's really trying to appeal to the evangelicals as he makes Iowa and a very important part of his campaign. Antonio, you want to tell us about your number?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can beat John's number, but I do have three, which is the Holy Trinity number, although it doesn't, it's not religious or spiritual, but rather three is the number of Florida men who are now candidates for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. That's because Miami Mayor Francis Suarez entered the race last week. And so we have a record number of Floridians seeking to be our next president, Trump, DeSantis, and now the mayor. Now, you may say, hold up, wait, we had three Florida men seeking the GOP nomination in 2016. But no, because at the time, Trump was a Manhattan man. And while he spent a good part of the year in Palm Beach, he didn't change his official residency status from New York State to Florida until 2019. You may also say, why does this fellow Suarez think he has a shot? I mean, he's just a mayor. And I will remind you that in 2020, people said the same about former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg's candidacy. And he turned out to be one of the standout Democrats that year and even parlayed it into a cabinet spot as President Joe Biden's current transportation secretary. Now, Suarez entered the race via speech at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. And he's presenting himself sort of this new age Republican who isn't so fond of the more extremes in the woke war, but rather a proponent of more cutting edge policies. One of the things that Suarez has been known for is trying to make Miami sort of this, Wall Street, or Manhattan Wall Street of the crypto world. His problem is that the recent failure of the cryptocurrency venture FTX, not because Suarez had any connection to it, but because Suarez, as Miami mayor, has been pushing again, like I said, to make Miami this cryptocurrency financial hub, you know, a Manhattan of Wall Street of digital currencies. Now, had FTX continued to be a successful enterprise, the Miami Heat Stadium, for example, was named after the company, you know, that would have bolstered Suarez's claim as his forward-looking leader and a departure from same old politics. Now, FTX failures doesn't keep Suarez from making that claim. Crypto money remains a major thing after all. But had the company not failed and brought a cloud over the crypto market, Suarez, I think, would have had a much stronger case to make with which to separate himself from the crowded field of candidates not named Trump. Nonetheless, I'll say keep an eye on Suarez in this race. He's gotten the attention of GOP mega donor Ken Griffin, and that's enough for the rest of us to be at least somewhat attentive to the mayor as well.
Yeah, as if we didn't have enough going on in Florida with DeSantis and Trump running for president, enter the Miami mayor to make things even more interesting. Well, my number is $35 million. That's how much money the campaigns and allies of DeSantis and Trump already have spent on television advertising nationally and in four early voting states, according to an analysis by Ad Impact. That campaign spending is about to ramp up dramatically with the Never Back Down Super PAC supporting DeSantis recently receiving $82.5 million in funds from the governor's state political committee. DeSantis raised more money than any governor in the history of the country, and we're about to see if it can move the needle for him in a presidential race that has so far been dominated by talk of Trump's indictments. Much of the money won't go to ad spending, though. Instead, Never Back Down is organizing a massive door-knocking effort in early states. These voters are about to hear a lot more about DeSantis. We'll see if they like what they hear. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production guru, Thomas Cordy, and thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.